I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Rodney Brooks, co-founder of Rethink, a company that makes robots for the manufacturing industry. In 1990, Dr. Brooks founded iRobot, which makes robots for the consumer and defense industries. iRobot's first consumer product was the Roomba, a vacuum robot introduced in 2002.
We built a lot of custom robots over time. We built some for NASA for experiments with Mars rovers to develop the software for exploring Mars. We built a robot for National Geographic that went into the Great Pyramid and crawled up a little tiny tunnel and cut a hole through to a cavity that was known to be behind there. It was very small, just a few inches, so a person couldn't get up there. Then the robot drilled a hole through to see what was inside this cavity, and there was nothing there.
Coming up, we'll learn how Dr. Rodney Brooks is building robots from scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Rodney Brooks, co-founder of Rethink, a company that makes robots for the manufacturing industry. Rethink's first robot was introduced in 2012 and is named Baxter. In 1990, Dr. Brooks founded iRobot, which makes robots for the consumer and defense industries. iRobot's first consumer product was the Roomba, a vacuum robot introduced in 2002. The company went public in 2005 and is headquartered outside of Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Brooks was formerly on the faculty at MIT from 1984 to 2010. His influential paper, entitled Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, was the inspiration for the Errol Morris documentary of the same name in 1997, in which Dr. Brooks is featured. Welcome.
Thanks for having me here.
Could you please define what a robot is?
Well, it's a bit like trying to define what art is, but I use the definition the robot is something that senses the world, does some computation, and then decides to act outside the extent of its own body. And I say outside the extent of its own body because I can't stand the thought of a dishwashing machine being a robot. It's not intelligent enough to me.
In 1990, you started your first robot company called iRobot with the intention to produce practical robots. What did you intend to build and to bring out to the market when you first launched the company?
When we first launched the company, we really didn't know. We were a bit naive, more than a bit naive. We knew we had technology to make robots mobile and move around, and we thought, well, everyone's going to like this technology. We'll just start a company. We've got a list of 14 failed business models we went through before we finally got the Roomba in 2002 and the military robots at the same time, and then we went public in 2005. But we had 14 failed business models, which weren't all bad models, just the world wasn't quite ready for some of them.
And what's one example of a model that the world wasn't ready for?
Well, one example was we were doing nuclear power plant inspection robots with the Japanese government, funded by MITI, Ministry of International Trade and Industry, partnered with Mitsubishi Heavy Industries. We did the research. We couldn't get traction for it to be a product until March of 2011, 1 week after the disaster, the Japanese government called iRobot. I was still on the board at that time, and said, please send some robots to Japan.
So instead of launching with a nuclear power plant robot, you launched with a vacuum cleaner. How did that happen?
Well, we had 14 models that we'd looked at, 14 different sorts of products. And all along, people said, well, I'd like a robot to clean my home. Back in 1990 or 1991 at my lab at MIT, we'd actually built a prototype vacuum cleaning robot. It wasn't very good. So eventually, towards the end of the 1990s, where we had learned to do low-cost manufacturing in China because we'd been doing toy robots for a while, we decided to have another go at building a vacuum cleaning robot. It wasn't the first vacuum cleaning robot on the market. The first one was from Electrolux for 2,000 euros in Europe. The key decision we made was we figured out that $200 was a price point that a person could spend without getting their spouse's approval. And so that became the target. The first model was $199.99,
wow.
September 18th, 2002.
You've said before that the robotic revolution parallels the PC revolution. And you've mentioned that when computers started to become more pervasive, they found their ways in toys and games initially before becoming more robust and complicated. Similarly, it seems like the Trojan horse for robots is also in toys and games and vacuums.
Yeah, well, in terms of the number of absolute number of robots, vacuum cleaning robots are more than any other sort of robot by far in the world. Industrial robots that are currently in factories really, to me, are like the mainframes of 30 years ago. Ordinary people can't touch them because they're dangerous. They're very hard to program. And then the PC came along around 1980, and slowly it started to get into offices, and ordinary office workers got to control computation. And the spreadsheet was the first killer app, if you like, where ordinary people could program the computer without having to be programmers. So we're trying to do the similar sort of thing for industrial robots, that ordinary factory workers can learn in minutes how to get it to do new tasks.
Just as the PC did not replace the human being and made the human being more ostensibly efficient, your claim with Rethink is that these robots for manufacturing are also assisting the human rather than replacing the human.
Yeah, very much so. I we didn't get rid of office workers. There's lots of office workers around. Now, the tasks that office workers do are very different from the tasks they did 30 years ago. They're much more empowered. And so I see a similar sort of thing with these industrial robots.
Could you walk through some of the other examples of robots that you've built? On the military side, you have these small unmanned ground vehicles that were launched in Afghanistan, for example. What other applications are there of these robots?
We built a lot of custom robots over time. We built some for NASA for experiments with Mars rovers to develop the software for exploring Mars. We built a robot for National Geographic that went into the Great Pyramid and crawled up a little tiny tunnel and cut a hole through to a cavity that was known to be behind there. It was very small, just diameter of the tunnel was just a few inches, so a person couldn't get up there. Then the robot drilled a hole through to see what was inside this cavity, and there was nothing there.
And when you were starting the company and you were seeking venture capital, I mean, this is the nascent stages of the robotics industry. What did that landscape look like?
Well, we didn't actually go after venture capital in 1990. It was totally self-funded, and we would get contracts and ask for half the money up front because we had to float, our payroll. In fact, for the first 8 or 9 years, we never knew that we were going to make payroll at the end of the month. We always did, though.
Hmm.
So it wasn't until 1998 that we started getting venture capital. It was 1998. It was boom times for the internet. I remember the most depressing interchange was Colin, Helen, and I, the three co-founders, on an August afternoon. It was hot. We were sweaty. We go into this one place, and they send out a summer intern, a junior in college, to talk to us. We start telling him what we're doing, and a few minutes in, he looks at us, he says, "You mean you build stuff? No one builds stuff anymore." And that was the end. So in fact, I went off and started my own venture fund. Got some money from some Swiss pension funds and started a little venture fund with some people I knew called Robotic Ventures. And we did a few investments, but I realized I wasn't very good at being a venture capitalist. We did fine, but I like pushing the boundaries of things that are almost impossible, and the role of a venture capitalist is to put discipline on the entrepreneur, and I was just the opposite.
And then fast forward to 2008, when you founded Rethink Robotics, you had an easier time raising capital after the success of iRobot. You and Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, were the early investors.
Yeah, when I founded Rethink Robotics, it was very much going to be a venture-based company. I put in some money, and Jeff Bezos' personal investment vehicle put in the other money for the very first Series A1, as we came to call it.
How did you meet Jeff?
Well, I met Jeff a long time ago. I first met him at TED, Technology, Entertainment, and Design Conference, and he was actually an investor in iRobot before it went public.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Rodney Brooks, co-founder of Rethink Robotics, a company that produces robots for the manufacturing industry. Dr. Brooks is professor emeritus at MIT. What was the catalyst for leaving iRobot and going to Rethink? I know that they are focused on different industries, but were there any pivot moments for you?
Well, I I had spent from 1997, I'd been going to China to learn to do low-cost manufacturing. I came to realize that was not going to be sustainable in the long term, that costs were going up in China. Even in the late 90s, if you were doing sewing for toys, that had already moved to Vietnam. So I could see sort of the writing on the wall. I sort of saw that people would want to do more manufacturing back in the United States. Had to be more productive. So I, being a robot guy, my answer was, let's have robots for manufacturing. But then people asked me, why didn't I do it inside iRobot? iRobot was sitting on a lot of cash, well over $100 million at the time I started Rethink Robotics. But if they spend that cash on a long-term development program, it comes off the bottom line, and Wall Street would slap them. So I presented the idea to the board, and as I expected, the board said, no, we can't spend our cash on that. I was under all sorts of agreements with them. They got equity in Rethink Robotics in return for releasing me from some of those agreements and got outside capital to start Rethink Robotics.
Now, Baxter's the name of the robot that you've launched. It cost $22,000. What does Baxter look like?
Well, Baxter's red and black. It has humanoid form. It has two arms. It has a LCD screen where the face would be, and normally there are eyes animated on that face, and the face always points towards any person who's nearby the robot. And when it's about to reach for something, the eyes glance at where it's about to reach. So if you're working in close proximity to it, it doesn't surprise you with an unexpected motion. It's a bit bigger than a human being. We tried to have it have human reach, but it doesn't have any hips, so we had to make longer arms. So I say it's like an Olympic swimmer is the size of the arms.
You mentioned Baxter's eyes. Are they functional or more social so that people interact with him as if he were a human being?
Yeah, we call Baxter an it because I try to make my robots deliver on any promise they give in their appearance. And I don't know what to promise in terms of gender, so I always call them its. The eyes... There is a camera right above the LCD screen, so it is actually seeing. But the animated eyes are really to give a person an understanding of what the robot is paying attention to.
Just on the subject of humanoid robots, what are the benefits of creating a robot that looks human-like?
Well, actually, when I started Rethink Robotics, I didn't believe we were going to build a humanoid robot. That was not the original intent. But over time, as we talked to many potential customers, a lot of them said they wanted to be able to replace the robot with a person. So that if the robot went down, they could just get a person in to take over temporarily so it didn't slow things down. So they wanted the reliability of replacing with a person. And that led us to build a robot with human-like capabilities in terms of what sort of things it could lift up, 5 pounds at full extension, and how fast it could move.
I've read before that one potential disadvantage of making a robot too human-like is that people might have disproportionate expectations of what it could do. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So, I say that if you make your robot look just like Albert Einstein, it better be as smart as Albert Einstein, or otherwise people are going to be disappointed. Mm-hmm. So we tried to make Baxter look have the appearance of about how smart it is, which is not really very smart.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the roboticist, Dr. Rodney Brooks. We'll hear more from Dr. Brooks coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Rodney Brooks, co-founder of Rethink, a company that makes robots for the manufacturing industry. In 1990, Dr. Brooks founded iRobot, which makes robots for the consumer and defense industries. iRobot's first consumer product was the Roomba, a vacuum robot introduced in 2002. Dr. Brooks was formerly on the faculty at MIT from 1984 to 2010. I've heard you say before there are four things needed to solve issues with robotics. Do you want to tell what they are?
So I've been telling people in research for a while that there are four aspirational goals. If we make improvement in any of these four, just improvement, the robots will get a lot better. So the first thing is the
the visual
capabilities of a two-year-old child. A two-year-old child, you can show them objects. You can show them a pair of glasses. They'll tell you it's glasses. You can show them a set of keys that they've never seen before. They'll tell you it's a set of keys. So getting to visual object identification capabilities of a two-year-old child. The language capabilities of a four-year-old child. A four-year-old child can understand accents. You don't have to dumb down the grammar. They may not know all the words, but they're learning words at an incredible rate. They understand questions. They understand conditionals. They understand a bunch of stuff at age four. At age six, the manual dexterity of a six-year-old child. A six-year-old child can tie shoelaces. A six-year-old child can do any task that is asked of a Chinese factory worker. They have that dexterity. They may not be able to play Chopin on the piano, but they've got the dexterity to do any sort of cooking task, any sort of task in the house, if they're so inclined. And the last one is the social understanding of an eight-year-old child. It's really a nine-year-old child, but I say eight to make it a pattern, where an eight- or nine-year-old child understands that a person different from them has a different understanding of the world, and they can reason about what that person knows because of what that person has been exposed to and seen in the world, and they don't make the mistake of thinking that everyone has the same model of the world as they do. If we had all those four capabilities, we would have the, you know, robots beyond my imagination.
And if this ideal robot were achieved, could the robot mature to be an older humanoid, you know, individual through pattern recognition and repetition, just as humans could?
It may. You know, our robot, even Baxter, does some sort of learning. But learning is such a loaded term because when human learning is so rich. So I didn't ask for the richness of human-level learning in those four capabilities. I was trying to make pretty much a robot that's a useful tool.
How much has your understanding of human behavior and the chemistry of the human body, how much have you had to enrich your understanding of those systems, even the spiritual life and the physical life of a human being, to help you in your robotic work?
During the 90s, my students and I at MIT really looked at child development a lot as inspiration for how to build the subsystems that could make up a robot that was adaptable to the world. Mm-hmm. And so that inspired us in trying to understand what software modules we needed to build to process sensory information and to control dexterous actuation.
You are considered a pioneer in the field of behavior-based robotics. And essentially, you advocate using decentralized systems to create robots rather than a centralized system. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, and I'll tell you how it fits in the Baxter context, actually. So you could have a top-down planning system where the wanted the robot to do some task and it would plan out ahead of time every single step and then follow that plan. And a lot of traditional AI, artificial intelligence, tries to do that. Baxter has lots of little behaviors that run in parallel. So, for instance, its arms will not collide with each other. If you try to bring them close together, they'll push each other away. It knows, a little rule knows, that it can't put something down unless it has something in its hand. So it has lots of little simple rules like that, which make it adaptable to a changing environment because it's not pre-computing exactly what it's going to do ahead of time. It's reacting to what's in the environment through many, many parallel, simple little behaviors.
Why did you pioneer this shift from centralized, you know, robotics to decentralized system? What do you see as the advantage?
Well, back in the 1980s, I was looking at trying to make robots navigate around in the world, and the computations were getting more and more complex. And I looked at little insects, and little insects with just 100,000 neurons were able to fly around and do all sorts of things we couldn't make a robot do with a big mainframe computer. So I realized there had to be a different way of organizing things.
In addition to studying childhood development to better inform your work, have you also thought, you know, just on a larger scale about, like, what human beings are? Like, what is your view of human life?
So I for a long time I was confused by how someone could be both a scientist and be religious. It didn't make sense to me. I'm an atheist. And then I realized that in my own life I had a duality of interpretations of the world. So if I look carefully at a person, they're a big bag of skin full of biomolecules which operate according to rules and are predictable in a sense. But my own children, I love unconditionally. I don't treat them as bags of skin full of biomolecules. I have two different ways of being in the world. I have the scientist way and the father way. And so I realize that we all have multiple views of the world, which we use at different times, and we're actually pretty comfortable about holding mutually inconsistent sets of belief. So, yes, I think we are all robotic, chemical robots. That is what we human beings are. And, by the way, all of modern science actually believes that. It's all about van der Waals forces and things like that. But people then have a different view of humans, which can be very spiritual or very religious.
Now, you know, your view of humans being chemical robots, you know, might not sit well with some people. And I've heard you say before how it's been hard for society to some extent to accept our lack of specialness. You know, we started off thinking we were the center of the universe and the sun revolved around us. And God
had made the earth for us because we were the peak of creation. And the one that really got it for me was Garry Kasparov. Garry Kasparov was beaten by Deep Blue, the world chess champion. Garry is a very sweet guy. I met him just a few months ago. But when he was beaten by Deep Blue in the 90s, the IBM supercomputer that beat him at chess, when he was beaten, he got up and he said, well, at least it didn't enjoy beating me. Because he still had the specialness that he had emotions, but the computer didn't have emotions. So, and I realize we're always trying to be special. We want to be special.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Rodney Brooks, co-founder of Rethink Robots, a company that produces robots for the manufacturing industry. Dr. Brooks is a professor emeritus at MIT. Incidentally, you mentioned you have children. You have four children. Are any of them in the field of robotics? What do they do?
None of my four children are in robotics, but my youngest daughter is actually an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley making engineering toys for young girls.
I want to talk about your upbringing. You grew up in Adelaide, Australia. Your father was a telephone technician, and your mother was a hairdresser. You spent some time as a child tinkering with leftover rocket equipment. Your dad was initially a telephone technician, but then he worked in a testing facility to help Europe build its first satellite launch system. Can you describe some of those early moments?
I actually had a book, the How and Why Wonder Book of Electricity, and another book, the How and Why Wonder Book of Computers and Giant Brains. And I got them when I was about 7 years old. They were American books. And they just gave a little bit enough information for me to start building simple circuits. And for some reason, I wanted to build intelligent systems. So when I was about 7 or 8, I built a computer, I called it, which was made out of nails and light bulbs out of flashlights and batteries and wires, which could play a very simple game where you took turns in taking away between 1 and 4 matches from a pile, and whoever ended up with the last match lost or won or something. And I built a circuit that could play that. And then I really worked hard. And by the time I was 12, getting a little more sophisticated switches out of old office switchboards as surplus equipment, I was able to build a computer, as I called it, which could play tic-tac-toe and not be beaten. And I wanted to build robots, but I wasn't dexterous enough to get things that could actually mechanically move. I could build circuits, but it wasn't until I was around 15 or 16 that I built my first robot.
And, you know, so you built your first simple circuit computer at 7 or 8 years old. Were your parents like, oh, that's nice. Okay, come in for dinner.
Well, actually, it was a little weird in that. I wasn't allowed to do it during the week because I had to watch TV like a normal kid. And on the weekends, I wasn't allowed to stay out in the lab, which was in a shed in the back garden, past 5 p.m. So I had to learn how to be. I'd think all week what I was going to do on the weekend, what I was going to build, and then I'd get in there and go at it as quick as possible.
Now, you were one of four children. Did your siblings participate in this?
My older brother had a chemistry set and in the same back garden shed, but no, they were not as dedicated to this as I was. I was an anomaly. In fact, my mother finished 10th grade, my father finished 9th grade, and at age 4, everyone called me the professor because somehow I was weird from birth.
You call it weird, but did you have a sense of self and, you know, continued confidence to say, okay, I am smart? Like,
well, I could do things, mental arithmetic in my head. I don't know what it was, except by age 4, I knew that I was better at computation, mm-hmm. arithmetic, than any adult. It was just something, a gift. It was something in me.
Now, there was one computer in Adelaide, Australia, and you had exposure to it.
When I was younger, there was an IBM computer mainframe in the city that you could see through a glass wall, and I would go and look at that. Mm. By the time I got to be an undergraduate at one of the local universities,
Flinders
University, they had a 16-kilobyte computer with 4 full-time operators running it during the week, and you could punch your cards, submit them, and 24 hours later you'd get your printout. But one of the professors really understood that maybe I, you know, had a lot of interest in this, and he arranged that over the weekend I was allowed to use that computer by myself for 12 hours every Sunday. So from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. on Sundays, I had that computer with one other student, and I got to recreate and learn computer science myself. There was no computer science being taught, but I got to learn it and figure it out for myself.
Now, you are so focused on, you know, math and arithmetic and computers and artificial intelligence at the time. How about your social life, your social development? Did you have girlfriends? And
I wasn't real good with girlfriends, but I did play various sports and went to parties.
You made your way to the United States. Initially, you went to Stanford and got a PhD at Stanford. How did being in the United States change possibilities for you,
I came to Stanford in 1977, and, you know, that was sort of the blooming of Silicon Valley. And I came from somewhere where there were almost no computers, and, you know, I would be in a McDonald's and hear people talking about software and programming at the next table. It was just such a different environment, and so I really was able to get immersed. I was able to, you know, go to Xerox Park and see the Alto at the same time that Steve Jobs was seeing the Alto and the mouse in the windows.
The Alto being the...
The Alto was the computer built at Xerox Park and was what essentially Apple copied to make the Macintosh.
And after getting your PhD at Stanford, you ended up at MIT, but it took you a few years to finally become on the faculty. And you said, even despite your rejections, you just kept trying. And there's a quote you once said that rejection is not the end.
No, rejection is not the end. I did not get accepted to MIT as a graduate student. I applied for a faculty job there 3 times before I eventually got a faculty job. And the other rejection is I actually failed my qualifying exam at Stanford in artificial intelligence. First exam I'd ever failed in my life.
Why did you know upon taking the exam that, oh boy, I'm failing?
I did not know that. I had got there and I was full of confidence, and I just wasn't ready for the qualifying exam, so I failed.
When you finally did become professor at MIT in the 1980s, you developed various robots with students in your robotics lab, and eventually you met your iRobot co-founders, Colin Angle and Helen Grainer. By the way, I was surprised to see that one of your co-founders, Helen, is a woman. How many of your students are women?
I had 27 PhD students, and I believe that 10 or 11 of them were women. Mm-hmm. So I had a lot more women in my lab than most robotics labs.
Is that ratio roughly the norm?
It really occurred because I had one woman, Anita Flynn. She had actually been at the Naval Academy, was really strong, aggressive, and new leadership. And that made it safe for other women to come in and join the lab. And then it just became a tradition that women worked in my lab and more came.
You were a faculty member at MIT for a quarter of a century. And so you kind of had this hybrid life where you were on both sides, both, you know, the academic life, but also the business world. Did that ever create conflicts within the university? Because more and more you had these professors entering business.
I was very careful to separate my two lives. So when we started iRobot, which was based on mobile robotics, I stopped doing mobile robot research and shifted to humanoid robot research, because that was going to be a place that iRobot was never going to go. So my grad students would not be worried that what they were doing with me as a research project was somehow feeding into my company.
Here we are, you know, just at the beginning of the robot revolution, where you saw PCs in the 1980s. Where do you see robots, let's say, 100 years from now?
I think robots are going to be pervasive, or robotic systems. Now, back in 1980, if you told people that they would have computers in their kitchens in the 1990s, they would have thought you were crazy. But instead, by the mid-1990s, there were computers, there were microprocessors in everyone's kitchen. So the robots that will appear in our world will not necessarily be the robots of science fiction or the robots of Hollywood, but robotic technology will be everywhere. So, for instance, Toyota, in their robot division, have recently announced a robot to help elderly people get into and out of bed. Doesn't look like a humanoid robot at all. It lets someone have a little more dignity and live at home longer, an elderly person, live at home longer because they can do stuff for themselves with that robotic technology, which otherwise they would need people to help them get into and out of bed.
Your mother is still alive. Your father passed away. What does she think of what you've become?
She's very proud of me, but she doesn't really understand my life. In fact, most of my friends in Australia from those days don't understand the sort of life I have. You know, they'd be, what do you mean you only teach one course? Being at MIT is just a little part-time job. They didn't understand the idea of a major research university. So it's a very different life from what I came from.
Just in your practical daily life, what are your encounters with robots in your own home? That maybe have you created any for yourself to help you make cereal in the morning?
I don't have any special robots. I do have a scuba, the small scuba that cleans my bathroom floor. I was using Roombas for a while, but I must admit I have a cleaning service right now that comes in and does that. But the scuba keeps my bathroom floor very clean.
Is there anything else that you feel a pain point in your home? Like, oh, I'd love to have something that makes my bed. Or
no, I sleep in an unmade bed.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Dr. Rodney Brooks. Coming up, we'll meet Peter Thiel, co-founder of PayPal. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Peter Thiel, the co-founder and former CEO of PayPal, an online payment system where anyone with an email address can send money using their credit card or their bank account. In 2002, eBay bought PayPal for $1.5 billion. Welcome. Typically, it's striking to me how when entrepreneurs start out launching a company, the company they set out to launch looks a lot different from the company it becomes ultimately. And I was wondering if you are a victim to that type of evolution.
Well, we started the company in late 98, and we launched the initial PayPal product in the fall of 1999. And I would certainly say that the very first year that we went through a number of different cycles in terms of trying to figure out what we were going to do. We started with security technology on mobile devices, a wallet, sort of a mobile cell phone payment system. And then in the summer and early fall of 1999, we stumbled on this idea of linking money with email. And I think you're right. This is not an unusual kind of a way for things to develop, especially at the very early stages of the company.
My understanding was that you went out to venture capitalists initially to try to raise money for this encryption software called FieldLink. And you weren't being very successful in raising that money, so then you then decided, okay, well, let's start a company called Confinity, which does provide payment options using the internet.
Yes. Yeah, we went through several different names early on. There was a FieldLink, then there was Confinity, and then we hit on we actually hired a naming company, and they came up with 1,000 different names, and we liked PayPal the best. But yes, so we did iterate through a whole bunch of these things. I probably spoke with, had maybe 100 separate meetings with venture capitalists or more in the course of 1999.
How did you meet your partner, Max Levchin? He's from the Ukraine, mm-hmm. and he was a programmer since he was about 10 years old. How did you and he come into contact initially?
I was giving a talk at Stanford in the summer of 98, and we talked afterwards and became friends, and basically he was trying to figure out how to start another company. He had already started a few of them back in college at University of Illinois. I was actually in the process of – I was running a very small fund at the time and helping invest in various companies and things like that. We basically started working together. I was going to help him find a CEO, so I helped him interview various people. And then at the end of the process, he asked me to be the CEO. And I said, well, you know, I'll do this for a few months till we get somebody else. And it then evolved into a four-year commitment. It was quite an extraordinary time.
What was your lecture, by the way, about at Stanford?
It was related to international finance or something like that, which is my background had been in finance.
You spent quite a lot of time at Stanford. You went to undergrad at Stanford, and then you went to Stanford Law School. And while you were at Stanford College, you started the Stanford Review, which is a libertarian conservative paper.
I had gone to Stanford for 7 years in a row, and so there was a whole set of people from that area that I was, you know, pretty familiar with, and had worked together. And it was actually one of the great things when we started PayPal was there were a lot of people we were able to hire from out of that network.
You're talking about the importance of community, which you really found in Silicon Valley and in Stanford. But it's ironic to me because it seems like both you and Max, to some degree, had quite a nomadic upbringing. Can you tell me a little bit about where you're from and how you got to California ultimately?
I was born in Germany. My parents emigrated to the U.S. when I was about a year old. We lived in Africa for a few years. And so I ended up going to about 7 different elementary schools, which is kind of a lot. But from about junior high school on, we were living in Northern California. Max was born in the Ukraine, as you said, and his parents emigrated to the U.S. when he was 16 years old. And as Max liked to put it, they left in August of 91, which is in the weeks when the Soviet Union disappeared and was replaced by Russia. And so he was a citizen of no country.
What was the impetus for your family to move to the
U.S.? My dad was just doing some master's college work in the U.S., and so he was an engineer.
And what was your mom doing?
My mom had been working for an airline, but then basically became a homemaker when my brother and I were born. And, you know, our family was sort of extremely – all sorts of things about everyone's families that are kind of eccentric and strange and interesting. But I think we were very, very focused on education. I remember one anecdote when I was growing up in fifth grade. My mother concluded that we weren't doing enough work in school, and the teacher wasn't pushing us hard enough. So one day, you know, she showed up in my class and just sat in on the class all day to see what was going on. And the various kids were saying, "Oh, your mom's here." And, you know, anyway, so, but it was, you know, I think it was a good thing on the whole.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. And my guest today is Peter Thiel, the co-founder and former CEO of PayPal, an online payment system where anybody with an email address can send or receive money using credit card or their bank account. There's a quote about you. Actually, you said, every month you think you're going to die, and every other month you think you're going to take over the world. And this is an emblematic of your sort of roller coaster ride with PayPal.
I don't know if that's something you have at every single company. I think a lot of them do feel like that on the inside, where it is a bit of this extraordinary roller coaster. And I think PayPal was an extreme version of this, and it grew at a rate of about 5 to 7% a day, compounding daily. So when you compound math is very powerful. So, you know, by mid-November, we were up to about 1,000 people. By the end of 99, we were up to 12,000. By February 2nd of 2000, we were up to 100,000. By mid-April, we were up to 1 million.
How did you achieve that growth?
Well, we had some initial bonuses that we gave people to sign up. And then in January of 2000, we noticed that a lot of people were starting to use it on eBay. And so we developed a lot of features that were especially targeted for the eBay auction market, and you know, where you had both people who were both buyers and sellers, which meant that you'd send money to someone and they would turn around and they'd buy something from somebody else. And so it was naturally sort of this incredibly viral place where you got phenomenal growth rates. So that was sort of the good thing. The growth was just, you know, off the charts. And then, of course, there were competitive issues in that large parts of the payment industry, you know, are fairly – nothing ever changes. You have sort of Visa, MasterCard – the Visa, MasterCard duopoly saw as a threat. There were government regulatory questions about how – what the regulatory regime for this was. So it was a completely new payment system. So was it a bank? Was it a money transmitter? You know, what were we? And what regulatory box did we fall in? You know, our initial position was, well, we shouldn't be regulated at all because we don't fit into any of the boxes. And then eventually we pushed for being regulated as a money transmitter, similar to Western Union, which I think is probably the correct box. And of course, that's much less regulated than, say, a bank.
So let's dissect that a little more, this Western Union notion. Ironically, I feel like you are innovative in that you are actually using cash to move around from buyer to seller, whereas other companies who were innovating were using, you know, cyber cash or digicash or replacements for dollars.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you thought initially of using those cash replacements, or from the inception you said, okay, no, we're going to be a little more old school and use actual cash.
One of the things that was a benefit when we got the company started in 99 was that there had been a whole slew of internet payment companies that had been started in the very first wave of internet companies back in 94, 95 that basically thought you were going to create this new electronic currency on the internet. And by 99, they had all sort of – were all sort of floundering for one reason or another. The most biggest one was people were just not using them, and so, you know, the question was, you know, why give someone cyber cash? You know, we could give you a chicken, or we could give you, you know, Malaysian ringgit, or we could give you a U.S. dollar. And in fact, currency is a massive network phenomenon. And, you know, the reason, you know, $100 bill is something that you would like to have is because there are other people who'd like to have that $100 bill. And so we're much better off giving you something which leverages off this already pre-existing currency network than trying to start a completely new one from scratch.
What did you do to incentivize people to adopt the service initially?
Well, we initially incentivized people by giving them referral bonuses.
Of how much?
It was about $10 if you signed up and $10 if you referred somebody else who signed up. So it was $20 per customer acquisition cost.
And were these all your friends initially?
It was initially the people at the company, and then they got other people to sign up and just rolled out in concentric circles like that. And you know, we initially were thinking, you know, this is crazy spending, giving people $20 to get them to sign up. But I realized that it was cheaper than all the alternatives.
How did you even have the cash initially to give $5, $10 per person? Where did you get that capital initially?
Well, we went through a whole series of venture capital financing rounds. Nokia was one of our early investors. We originally started with this sort of wireless small device focus.
How much did they invest?
They invested initially about $3 million. Then we had another financing round late '99, but then in early 2000, March 2000, as the service was taking off, we raised about $100 million, which turned out to be quite fortuitous timing. People, you know, they were lining up to write us checks because it was, you know, at the very peak of the boom.
But then that turned very quickly.
Yes.
So you were very lucky to get in and raise that money.
We closed the $100 million round on Friday, March 31st. And I remember it was the next Monday the market basically collapsed.
I want to go back to the competitive situation. There were a lot of companies that came and went before you came on board. But there was one competitor that stuck and that might have been a formidable foe for you guys, and that was X.com. What were they doing that made you pay attention to them?
There were a number of people who launched these services around the same time. And basically, Confinity, which had the PayPal service, and X.com were the two that had launched them at more or less identical times and were both growing very, very quickly. It was, you know, this ferocious competition. They were four blocks down the street from us in downtown Palo Alto.
Did you know them personally?
We didn't know them personally, but, you know, you sort of had, you know, you had a meeting every day. We're, you know, we're exhorting the engineers to, you know, work harder. And it's a somewhat disturbing account of human nature. I'd never seen people work as hard as, you know, when it was like, you know, the enemy is four blocks away. You know, both companies were spending money at an exponentially growing rate. You know, our customer base was growing exponentially. We also had exponentially growing burn rates. And it turned out we were both kind of freaked out about it. And so we finally decided in early March to do this 50-50 combination between the two companies, which had all sorts of challenges. So, you know, each company had about 60 people. You combined them into one company with 120. So it was like you hired all of a sudden 60 people that you hadn't interviewed. But it was worth it, if for no other reason than that gave the company the necessary momentum to raise that $100 million in March of 2000 that then carried the combined company to profitability.
Whose decision was it to merge with X.com, or at least to start a conversation with X.com? Did you say one day, okay, I'm going to go down four blocks and knock on their door?
It was December 31st, 99. I was on the internet. I decided, well, I have to actually get an account on X.com to see what our competitor is doing. So I signed up the account, and 10 minutes later, the CEO from X.com called me up and said, welcome to our service, and then suggested that we should maybe talk. And we ended up getting together and over the next few months figuring out a way to get the companies to work together.
I want to talk some more about the competitive situation, about the credit card companies and the banks. Why did they look you over initially?
I would say there were two things. One was that the whole thing happened incredibly quickly. So, you know, you have to realize nobody was expecting a new payment service to arise in, you know, a matter of months. And then I think the second part of it was that, you know, at the end of the day, we did not actually take away business from Visa or MasterCard. If anything, we expanded their business because we enabled people to use their credit cards in contexts where they'd never used credit cards before. And so, yes, some of the larger payment companies would have preferred to capture this market for themselves entirely. But at the same time, it was not as though there were people working at these companies whose jobs were being threatened if we were going to be successful, because this was just not a market they were in at all. It was a completely new market.
When you first met Max and you understood that he had a good computer programming acumen, how were you convinced that his technology and the technology that you were building was ironclad and was more secure than everybody else's? I mean, because that is really the heart of your business, is
yes,
to be able to transact in a very secure, protective way.
Well, there were several technology challenges. I mean, one was obviously to make the thing scalable so that you could serve millions of people and it wouldn't break. And Max had actually built some scalable systems before, so we're pretty confident on that score. The security piece was a bit trickier in that, you know, we didn't quite appreciate all the security challenges that we would have. In some ways, had we appreciated them, we might never have launched the company. And it's not like it's a single tech problem to solve. It's more like this iterative process of dealing with all kinds of different, very creative people in, you know, Russia and various other places trying to figure out new and improved ways to steal your money. You know, there were conventional ways you could have solved it by requiring, you know, enormous amounts of information about each customer before they used the service. But that would have just basically made the service unusable. So you have to sort of look at the fraud problem in the context of some of the other challenges, such as the convenience challenge. And so the real issue was this trade-off between how much fraud would we tolerate versus how inconvenient did we want to make it for customers.
That's right.
If there was no trade-off, you could have stopped the fraud pretty easily, but you would have pretty much shut down the service too. And this was actually one of the challenges a lot of the large banks had. They were very focused on the fraud problem, but they ended up creating services that were basically unusable. And I think that ended up being one of the most valuable technologies that actually was developed. It was certainly not what we thought was going to be the core technology, but it turned out to be a core competitive asset just because people were not willing to enter the business because they didn't understand the fraud problem.
We did talk before about eBay becoming a surprisingly good complement to PayPal. And after you went public in 2002, eBay bought you shortly thereafter. How long were you public before eBay bought you?
Well, we took the company public in February of 2002, And then eBay announced the acquisition in July, 5 months later, and it was completed in October towards the end of 2002. So we had had conversations with eBay for a number of years before then. There clearly were enormous synergies. It was very difficult to know what the right value of it was. Once the company had been taken public, there was sort of a market valuation on it, and then it was much more straightforward at that point to negotiate a deal with eBay.
How much money did you raise in the public offering?
We raised about $70 million. We had raised about $220 million in private capital beforehand.
I've heard before that you think that PayPal is linked to sort of international peace or prosperity. And I was wondering if you can narrow that down a little bit more. What do you mean by that?
That's so megalomaniacal. You know, I think that if we can have a system in the world based on trade instead of people fighting each other, that would be sort of make for a much, much better world. And that's, you know, I'm very much in favor of free trade, free movement of capital, trying to help people forge commercial relationships across all sorts of geographic and cultural barriers. And I thought that sort of the critical part of the infrastructure for that is a seamlessly functioning global payment system. The T-shirt slogan was PayPal was the new world currency. And I think that turned out, you know, we didn't quite live up to that, but I think to the extent we've pushed the envelope a little bit more in that direction, I think it has made the world a better place. I really do.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Awesome. Thank you very much for having me, Jesse.
My guest has been Peter Thiel, the former CEO and co-founder of PayPal. To learn more about the show, visit our website at fromscratchradio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.